But the first witness I'm going to talk about is a local woman who lived up the road from the Swiftwater station. She had been local to that area for a long time, and it was probably about between quarter of seven and 7 o'clock, same night, February 9th, 2004. She takes off from her house and she's going to walk down to the Swiftwater station, which is like a little convenience store gas station, still there today. So she's walking down the road like she always does, and she notices a red truck that passes her, slows down and stops a little bit. And she doesn't think much of it, doesn't feel nervous or scared. She just thinks that in her head, she thinks that, oh, they're looking for somebody, or maybe is it somebody that's looking to see if they know me? It looked to her like they slowed down because they thought they recognized somebody or they're looking for somebody. Then it sped up and it took off. So she's just walking still, and she notices, she thinks that they had Massachusetts plates. And she said that was one of her initial statements. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a number, doesn't have any like recall. She kind of frustrated. She said if they had questioned me earlier on, I might have been able to give them a couple,
you know, like letters out of it or numbers.
I don't know if this was from her, you know how it goes. We're not going to get into the rabbit holes of Reddit. We'll be there for months, years. We'll friggin' be 80 years old by the time we cover all the rabbit holes of Reddit. But she, somewhere along the line, I thought I read that they thought that maybe one of them was a 3. But she's pretty certain it was a Massachusetts plate. But it also was getting dark. Mm-hmm. So she continues on her journey. She gets to the parking lot of the Swiftwater station, and the red truck is parked in the parking lot.
Hmm.
Now it's about 7:05, 7:10, right around there.
Hmm. Funny meeting you here again.
As soon as she walks up to the door of the store, the red truck takes off and is heading in the direction of where Maura's car will eventually be found, or the crash will eventually happen. She goes into the store, and per her report, let's call this witness the initials. We won't say the name. The name's out there, so it's not like it's protected, but R.O. She knew the owner of the store because they're all local, so she starts talking, and she's just kind of shooting the shit with them. And she asks him, she said, hey, she goes, did anybody just come in a little bit ago? No, nobody's come in. Oh, okay, it's so strange. She goes, there was a red truck parked in the parking lot, but they never came in. Nope, nobody came in. Didn't think anything of it again. They just kept talking. Now it's 7:20, 7:25-ish, and they see EMS and fire trucks go by with lights on, and they're in the store. Don't think anything of it. Probably just said, hey, I wonder what's going on. Mm-hmm. So that's her story, and that's where her story ends. And now we have another witness, which I don't know if they are corroborated. I don't know exactly where this came from. I think it probably came from one of the private investigators in the area that had interviewed a lot of people around the case back when it first happened, and he was working close with the family. Mm-hmm. So apparently there was another local resident or a woman walking her dog on, I believe, Bradley Hill, which Bradley Hill Road is not too far. It's an off-road, a back road off of the route 112 where the crash happened. So the crash is like right here on the curve, and Bradley Road, I believe, is the next road closest to that area, and it goes up a hill. Mm-hmm. There was a woman walking her dog up there, and allegedly she saw a red truck.
Oh, the red truck? Here we go again.
Independent of the other witness. And this red truck, she said that there was nobody inside of it, and both doors were, and the door was open. But nobody was in there. Jeez. Except, so the lights, you know, when you open the door, the, what do you call that? The light.
The overhead. Oh my God, overhead light, yeah. Door
so
light, whatever.
Nobody in the truck parked on Bradley Hill. And apparently her dog was, I don't know if this is important or whatever, but the dog, she remembers this clearly because she was frustrated because her dog wouldn't listen to her because it was barking and like paying attention to a bush.
Oh.
And it wouldn't stop barking or, like, sniffing at a bush that was near the truck. So that's why she remembers that. Now, this lady had no idea of the other witness's story. These are all independent of each other. And then the final witness that we're going to talk about, which is famously called Witness A. Now, in later episodes, we'll get into there's also been a Witness B and now a Witness C, allegedly, that have come out. But Witness A is I believe she's a psychiatrist, and she worked in another town. And she drove the same way home every single day. And she always called her husband at the same time when she was about to lose cell service. So from her drive, there was cell service up into a certain point. And when she got to the bottom of the hill, that's where she knew she lost it. So she would call him just to let him know, I'm safe. I'm about 10 minutes out. I'm going to lose cell service now. See you soon. So that was her routine. So this night on her drive home, and she remembers because she has the phone call of when she called her husband, the date and the time, which is about 7:52 is when she called her husband. So she passed the accident scene approximately probably like between 7:35 and 7:42 around there. And it's about another 10 minutes for her to get to that bottom of the hill where she usually calls her husband. Oh, okay. So that time would match up. So she thinks what she saw when she went by is a black car crashed. I don't remember if she said the door. I believe she said the door was open. And a police SUV 001.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Parked nose to nose with the Saturn. She also, on her drive, a police SUV 001 had passed her twice as she was driving. Once, it seemed like they passed her and then again either went up a side road and somehow ended up passing her again. I don't understand all of that. But she got passed twice by this police SUV, and she's certain 001. Mm. And then when she got to the crash scene, it was nobody was there as far as she remembers, and she saw the black car nose to nose with the same SUV that had passed her. Didn't think anything of it. Kept going. Her phone call is on record. Police have her records that show that she called same night at 7:52. She called her husband to let him know that she was coming home. So that's a witness. And her account of things, it doesn't match up with what we know from the police statements and the dispatch logs. So that has thrown a lot of questions into that. She's been discounted by the local police as not being reliable, being wrong on her days, being wrong on her nights. It sounds like per different podcasters and reporters that it was so bad that she was so discounted, she didn't even want to talk to anybody about it anymore.
Damn, that's pretty bad.
Could she have been mistaken on what vehicle she saw? Definitely. Could it have been a different day entirely? Maybe.
Like, what are the chances?
I mean, this lady, I would say, probably has a master's degree or a doctorate. It was something out of the ordinary that she didn't usually see that would have been, she would have remembered. And she remembers that it was the same night because she has the phone call. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
That's all I'm going to say.
And as far as the police are concerned, the only dispatch officer that arrived on scene was in a sedan, 002, was Cecil Smith. Per them, the SUV that they're talking about, which normally the chief would drive, was out of commission.
Convenient.
So we're not going to go into police conspiracy. If anything, we're going to go through just some statements that just don't quite match up. The investigation, the lack of investigation, the lack of transparency. But we'll leave it there, that these are a few accounts and reasons why the police are questioned so much in this case. After that, we had the potential sighting of a young woman running 5 miles down the road. We talked about the red truck sightings. There have been reports that police were doing stop and checks of red trucks that evening. And we're not going to get into theories. We'll save that till the end, until we go through everything. And we'll kind of go through what we think, different theories out there. But I will just put an exclamation point right here that to me, and I have gone back and forth and back and forth. And I think, you know what? I think if you're someone that has had your mind changed a million times in this case, you're looking at it from a responsible manner. You're looking at it open-minded, and you're not going to just take one theory and, like, that's it.
And run with it, basically. It's like, no, you're going to listen to all the facts, and you're exactly. going to be like, oh, wow, there's a lot more going on to this case than I originally thought.
And the fact is, there's only one thing that happened that night. There could be a couple, but one story is true. That's it. There's one reality. Everything we're speculating on, it's guessing. We weren't there that night. We don't know. We're not going to know until either we find Maura or somebody comes forward and tells us what happened. But understanding the case and understanding the environment and what was going on and with witness statements, like Sam said earlier, we have puzzle pieces. We just don't have the picture. We have missing pieces. But there is a real picture of what happened and where she ended up. 100%. And I believe that there is somebody that knows something.
And they're just hoping they can hold on to it until things blow over.
And unfortunately, the longer we go on, we're going on 20 years in February, witnesses and people die. They move away.
They're gone.
The information gets lost. Evidence gets lost. And it's really frustrating.
Yeah, the case just gets colder. Case just gets colder as more time passes, unfortunately. And we're finding a lot of these cold cases are now getting solved because we had DNA evidence stored away. We all this and that. But there's just so much with this case that we don't have. And that's where the problem lies.
The police, it's an open investigation, but it is at the cold case unit now. I do believe that there are investigators working hard on this case. They have a better relationship with the family, it sounds like, in recent years. But the family has also been left in the dark. A lot of it. The public has been left in the dark. What happens when you're not transparent with the public?
I feel like assumptions are made and then conclusions are jumped to because our brains, like we talked about earlier, we love to hypothesize. We love to try to understand. And our brain's going to plug in the gaps with things that we think we know and understand.
And what?
To try to understand the problem.
And what ends up spreading all over the rumors. Internet? Misinformation.
Yep.
Rumors that become fact. Yep. And you know what would help that? And
or I get disguise it. Disguise themselves as fact.
Yeah. And I get it. I get the police and the investigators. It's an open investigation. We can't release some of the information. I mean, do we really believe they have a lot of information about anything? I don't know. But I understand that they have to protect information, DNA, potential suspects, witnesses, because of maybe a court case in the future. It's been 20 years. I understand the frustration about internet sleuths and Reddit and all the crazy theories and trolling that's been going on. But you know what? You could have prevented that by having some conferences, having some public community events to tell us what exactly is going on. Not even talking to the family. The family's in the dark. The sister, poor Julie, 20 years, she's doing her own investigation now. She's trying to piece together. Why is that her job? Yeah. And unfortunately, this isn't the only case. This case has been fortunate to have the amount of coverage and attention on it, but that's what makes me so fucking mad is it's had so much attention and eyes on it, and we don't fucking know a fucking thing about it.
Nothing has changed. I shouldn't say nothing's changed. That's a bold and presumptive lie, but we haven't made much progress.
No, and I get it. Like, it's hard to say what happened because she poofed, disappeared. But that night, there could have been a lot more investigated.
Oh,
that
yeah.
week, there could have been a lot
that
more.
That year? That whole year.
I mean,
year.
You had a vulnerable 21-year-old child who possibly might have been hurt. And yes, they did do searches. They did look around, but EMS was called out to the scene and released 10 minutes later. Hmm. Nobody really searched the east where supposedly there was maybe a sighting of her running. They sent the bus driver to the east to go search for her. Like, isn't he your main suspect? Yeah. Because he was the one talking to her.
Exactly. The last person you saw her.
Maybe you want a professional going down that way, not send the bus driver. That might have had something to do with it.
Also, I love how they inherently trust the bus driver guy. Not saying he did it, but they just like inherently trust him. And they're again, like, oh, we believe you. Go find her. Right. But then the other witness, they're like, fuck you. You're lying, bitch. Like, you know what I mean?
It's just.
So we're just going to believe the man.
And you wonder why. We'll just believe
him. And then this woman who's actually got a degree and extremely educated. Light's playing tricks on you, lady.
And you're like, from a small town, right? Different culture?
Yes, definitely.
With the police?
Especially depending on who you are. And usually there's only a few people on the police force. And a lot of the same people volunteer on the firefighter, like, basically. So they'll be volunteer firefighters, but then they're also somehow on the police squad. But there's only, like, three of them. And all they do is do traffic runs, basically, or if, like, you call someone and you need them to come check on you. But even then, a lot of the time, it's, like, who you know. And I definitely know I'm not going to say much, but I was in a relationship with someone who was related to a higher-up police member in our town. And let's just say you get away with shit if you know the right people, like, very much so. That's
commonplace.
Yes. And there's definitely a lot of, like, the old buddy system, old boy system. And so the fact that a lot of people said that the sheriff used to drive around drunk.
The chief.
The chief of police used to drive around drunk. It doesn't surprise me. I'm not saying that happened in my small town, but I'm just saying I could easily see something like that happening because of the dynamic and structure.
And him getting away with it.
There's no one to check you. Like, there's no one to check you, and it's the old boy system, and even if one of your coworkers would check you, they wouldn't, because guess what? These are the only people you have around, and this is, like, your team, and you're not going to betray your team. Like, you're just going to keep it a secret. So then when you get into trouble, they'll help you.
Oh, 100%.
It's like a loyalty system.
And you know, like, if you're Cecil Smith, you're hoping to be chief one day. So you want to be in the good graces. You don't want to get ostracized.
And you don't want to get in trouble when something comes out and that you were a part of it or have it somehow turned on you.
Right.
Because you knew about it. Just even knowing about it.
Right.
You don't know what this man has for evidence or what he could pin on you. You know, I'm just saying, I'm not trying to make my views obvious from the start because we're going to get into it later, but I'm just saying I think the way they handled this case, it's like definitely giving the old boys system to me.
Now,
and it's giving very small town police force vibes to me.
So you're on patrol and you're called out by neighbors. You know them, probably all of them, because it's you all live there. Everyone knows everybody. You get a report of a girl shooken up and disappeared. I guess I don't know what their thoughts were. Their thoughts, because to me, you'd be very concerned and you'd be wanting to find her as soon as possible. Whether or not you think that there's anything suspicious going on.
Just the fact that it's February. Just the fact that it's cold
and she got in a car wreck. You see a crack in the windshield.
And like, just the fact that it's dark and cold and you can't find her. It's a February night.
Yeah.
In New Hampshire. Like, the other day we had a patient who was literally came into the ED and was bored overnight because it was so cold. He was dying of hypothermia, and it's only, what, November here in Mass, so that's further down south, so it's warmer than it is up in New Hampshire.
And
in February, it's a lot colder up in those White Mountains. Like, come on. Like, you would have been totally worried that she's going to become hypothermic and die.
And if you have any type of
rational thought. Yeah, and I mean, she's drinking, so she's going to stay vasodilated and warm for a while, but she's also, like, not cognizant, and she's not able to, like, navigate the area, so she's more likely to end up, like, dead in a ditch somewhere, like, frozen to death. So I, as a police officer, would be very concerned and want to seek her out immediately and try to find her before she could go further. But, I mean, what do I know? I'm just a nurse.
But wouldn't you make an effort to notify the family immediately?
Yes, and not 48 hours afterward.
It was 24.
Oh, sorry.
I guess, to be fair.
Oof, sorry. Let's give them some grace. 24 hours.
But I guess it could be a situation. We've run into this before where we've had patients, not no identification, no history in our records, trying to reach out to a family member they might not answer. It sounds like they ran the information. The vehicle was actually her mother's. Oh, I'm getting this mixed up. Because Brianna Maitland, it was her mother's car. I want to say this vehicle, it was Maura's that she drove, but it was registered under Fred Murray, her father. He was in Connecticut at the time on a job. He was a radiological technician or radiological, tech. So he worked in Connecticut. He did like contracts or whatever. So I don't know if it was a situation that they did try to get a hold of him and they couldn't because of work. So then eventually they were able to get a hold of her sister, because it sounds like the first person that they were able to get a hold of was Maura's oldest sister, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. And then once Kathleen found out, they kind of did like the telephone tag thing. Like then she called everybody. I will say maybe it took them a while to verify like who the heck this was, because the car information was not registered under Maura. But like you said before in our previous podcast, it's like you still got called out there for a young 21-year-old shaken up girl who just crashed a car.
Mm-hmm. And there's multiple witnesses, supposedly. You know what I mean?
It took them 4 to 6 days to even really do a strip ground, helicopter search, dogs. Like, there was just, it just seemed like there was no
protocol like followed.
Right, and no sense of urgency.
Yeah.
We weren't there that night. We weren't there that night. You might also come across abandoned vehicles that people run away from because they don't want to get a DUI all the time out there.
I was going to say, this literal situation happened in my small town where a guy was drunk driving and he went off the road and got his car stuck in a ditch and he like left. And he had like called the chief of police in my town, and I'm pretty sure he like let the guy get away with it, like too, because then he ended up that said guy ended up attacking the person's family member. Anyway, but yes, the person was like drunk driving and crashed into a ditch and was literally allowed to go because, you know, good old boy system. He was part of the fire team or whatever, fire brigade or firefighter team.
Yep.
So yeah, that's just interesting. Because literally I remember the chief of police talking about this situation, and I was just like, so you let him go and he was drunk driving. Interesting. Or like the guy was, he basically ran from the scene, but he didn't get in trouble. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like they found his car. It's just.
Because they can say, well, I wasn't driving.
It works different in a small town. Someone stole it. Especially when you're a white man. Not to be that person, but.
Right. No. Privilege.
It's true.
Back 2004, I mean.
So, like, the whole, like, it's weird when you're saying this. I'm like, wait a minute. Someone in my town literally did this situation that Maura did.
And I know Montana, it happened quite a bit. It's not uncommon.
Like, people do ditch their cars.
You're not going to assume in a small rural town that a girl got abducted. You're going to assume that she was drinking. She ditched the car. She'll come back to the car later.
We'll find her eventually. She'll show up.
I mean, I can see it, right? It's not right. It's not a right mindset to have.
But definitely a small town mindset.
And you can feel, even working as a nurse in the emergency room, oh, here comes the drunks again. All the drunks. You hear that. You know what I mean? Like
that police force is not equipped to deal with that.
Equip with that. Now, and that's another thing we'll get into later, but the FBI were involved in the search efforts. I don't know to what extent, but very quickly the FBI left, and the father immediately got up there and did searches, immediately connected with a PI, because the police were not only suspicious of him or maybe giving him the runaround or not seeming to take what he was saying seriously. It sounds like Fred got up there the next night, I think around like 6 to 8 p.m., and then the rest of the family followed also. He was able to view the car, and he made a comment or something to the cops, like, I hope she didn't come out here to do the squaw walk. Have you heard of that term?
No.
So I guess it just means, I hope she didn't come up here to hurt herself.
Oh, kill herself. Got it. Squaw, like suicide squad walk? Squaw walk? I don't know.
I don't know if it's a Native American term or I don't think I've ever heard it. But that's what he said. And so then he quickly, which I don't know, as a parent, I'm sure that he knew what she was going through. He knew that she had been going through a hard time. She had just crashed his car.
Yeah.
You don't really know why they're up there. Like, why on earth did she come up here? It's a place that we go as a family.
Plus, in your mind, you don't know anyone who'd want to take your child. So you're kind of, like, assuming it's something of her own doing. You know what I mean?
Right.
You're like, wait a minute. Like, who would she be meeting up with? You know what I mean? Because the boyfriend exactly. is not in town.
I just talked to her yesterday. Like, she was going to get accident forms for the car crash. Everything was fine. I told her that, you know, I wasn't mad. Like, we were going to get through this. She's not a troublemaker. She's just going through some hard stuff. We're going to get her a new car. So it sounded like on Sunday night when they spoke, they left everything on a positive note. So this kind of her leaving and going out of the area, that kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, they're like,
according to what he's telling us.
Yeah.
And he made some comment about, I hope that she didn't commit suicide or come up here to hurt herself. And for whatever reason, the police really, I guess, latched on to that.
I wonder why. Anyway, continue. Sorry. We'll get into that.
So very quickly, Fred Murray, he changed his tune and he said, by talking to some of, I think, the locals, some of the witnesses, some of the people that actually were there, he started getting a really quick picture in his head that no. She didn't walk into the woods, just like we talk about now when we've gone through all the case facts that we know.
Yeah.
Listening to the Missing Maura Murray podcast, they kind of been up there in that area. They talked to people like John Smith who have been investigating the case from the beginning. It's not a place where you just walk into the woods. There was no footprints. The tracking dogs and the scent dogs tracked her scent 100 yards up the road and stopped in the middle of the road. You know, granted, it's winter, if it was windy, like there was some talk about the gloves they used, how often did she actually wear them? But it looks like if you're taking that as evidence, it looks like she got into a vehicle. So you put all those small things together. And now you're thinking, okay, yes, she crashed her car. We don't know why she's up here. But all of that aside, somebody took her or she got into a car and then somebody abducted her or did her harm. Or, you know, who knows if she got into a car and then she got brought somewhere, maybe something happened over there. To me, though, with all the attention the case gets, if there was a car that honestly was a good person, we probably would have heard from them by now. The fact that we haven't heard from anybody makes me think that it was not a good person if she did get in a car. I mean, it's still a possibility that she did walk off and get lost in the woods and fall down a cliff and we would never see her or find her. That is a possibility. People get lost in the mountains, national parks, all the time. You have a little alcohol in your system.
Especially if you're feeling confident, because you know that area for the most part. I know I would probably be a little more cocky in my hometown where a lot of people would not feel confident.
Right. Well, that area, we don't know if she knew that little area. But yeah, the White Mountain, she's no stranger to that area.
So sometimes that can make you foolish and reckless. Not saying that she was foolish and reckless. I'm just saying that, like, she's probably more prone to make a mistake somewhere where she feels like maybe, like, I've been here before, and
right.
I kind of know what I'm doing, and I can get away with having a little bit of a drink
right.
while I'm driving here, as long as I go slow.
100%.
Like, so, I know where the curbs are.
The weird thing, so that's the weird things about this particular night, and on our next episode, we're going to go back to UMass and West Point and we're going to tell the story of what was going on before and what led her up to that point. Tonight, we just really want to focus on the accident scene, the culture, maybe some of the psychology. But that's how the scene ended up. Fred and the rest of her family went up to New Hampshire, and they began their search and their questioning and their investigation. And they hooked up with some private investigators when they really didn't get a lot of support, I guess, from the local police. And some of the stuff the police were telling them didn't seem to match up or just didn't seem to add up. So for whatever reason, the relationship between the local police and Fred Murray and the rest of her family was not good. It deteriorated. Fred had begged them for years and years to get the FBI involved.
Which they refused to do.
Which, for whatever reason, they didn't do that. They refused. He went to court about it. Finally, 2022, the FBI is now involved. I don't know how much in the case, but she has been added to VICAP, which that poster and that information will be on our website and in the show notes. And her case has been transferred to the New Hampshire State Cold Case Unit, where it is still actively being investigated. And it seems like, I don't know if it's some new people coming into the state police or that area police, it seems like the relationships are a little bit better. It sounds like Julie Murray is the main spokesperson for the case now, and she's kind of taken on that investigative role because her father, he's in his 80s. He's getting up there. He's still doing a lot of work. He's still very spoken, but she's kind of stepped up and she's kind of going to be the main source now, which I think is awesome because she's done an amazing job. She's on TikTok. She created Mora Talk. So if you guys want to listen to and learn more about the case from a family member's perspective, she's done a lot of amazing TikToks that have details and information that we never even knew before. Like, for instance, one detail that I had never heard before, which is going to make Sam do a double whiplash take. Apparently, the car being found, now granted, we don't know how long it was sitting anywhere else or what was done or what the investigation took, because they could have parts of that car that they put into evidence. We know that the whole muffler, is it the muffler? The tailpipe?
Yeah, the tailpipe.
They took that whole thing into evidence. So we know that. Well, apparently the rear view mirror was missing.
Interesting. That's strange.
If you were struggling in a car,
what would you grab?
What would you grab?
Especially if there's something hanging from it, which most young girls do.
So Maura's sister points out that she found that odd.
That is very strange.
She also, on one of the videos, shows a picture of a weird imprint in the, I forget what you call it, like the T, like what's that panel? The T panel, like where the window is, that little side panel with paint on the car. It looks like there's a possible like shoe imprint.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, you're trying to.
Interesting. Yeah.
So this is stuff that I have never heard. So that's what I'm saying. This is from the family.
That is interesting. I've never heard that before. So
I'm actually going to be, before we do our next episode, I need to finish going through all her TikToks because she's got a ton of videos because she, and now what's really funny is the family hasn't really had access to many of the police reports. But being the family, they obviously do have a lot of information because they've been working with private investigators. And because she wants the public's help, because she wants us to keep talking about Maura, put Maura's name out there. That's what she begs. People want to know what they can do for this case or how they can help.
Talk about
her. That's what we're doing here. That's what this podcast is about. We're shining a light on these cases. We're trying to give victims and their families voices. And we're going to be covering cases that are well known. We're also going to be covering cases that you've never heard about that maybe need a light shine on their case. They need attention because, unfortunately, people go missing every day. And a lot of them, we don't even know about. They're not covered. True. They don't have resources. They might not fit the what sells story.
I was going to say the demographics are different. So, unfortunately, they don't get the coverage they deserve.
Correct. Might be minorities. It might be a population that's just vulnerable.
I was going to say certain populations that people don't want to investigate.
Yep. And that's changing. That's why it's exciting to be in true crime right now, is because we're having these conversations about being ethical, covering true crime and looking at these cases in an ethical way, supporting each other and collaborating instead of exploiting. And I think that's going to draw us to a close of episode one. I want to thank you guys so, so much for listening and supporting. Please join our Facebook fan page. Please send us an email. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. I know we're, because of our background, we really enjoy the psychology of stuff and human behavior. So we kind of are going to end up going on tangents probably, but that's just how we do it. You might love that. You might hate it. It might be too much. Please let us know. We take criticism, and just be kind to one another. Help each other out.
Be a good person, you know.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah, basically, don't be a dick. Don't be a Richard. And just try to do a little thing every day to improve yourself 1%. Every day.
Self-care.
Yeah, self-care. And try to do things that you feel you'd be proud if that was your imprint and the last mark you left behind. Live your life every day with integrity and treat others the way that you would want to be treated.
And we do talk and discuss some triggering topics that might be hard for some people to hear. So if you are having a hard time, please reach out. There is the crisis line that you can call at any time. There is help out there, and don't be afraid to ask for help anytime you need it. It's not weak. It's not embarrassing. We all need help sometimes.
Yes, agreed. And it takes a village. And I think we learn a lot about ourselves through our vulnerability and a lot about the human experience through our vulnerability, and to understand that so many of us go through the same shared experiences just through a different lens. Is really important to realize that, because we would really be taking something away from ourselves as humans if we didn't recognize that thing that bonds us together, even if it is a shared human experience of struggling or having a tough time or going through something really, really rough, you know, feeling depressed, feeling anxious. I think those are symptoms that many of us can relate to right now with the current state of the world and the way things are, the pressure being put on us. But mm-hmm. I think sometimes when we hear each other out and really listen, we see that we truly are not alone, and so many people struggle. And while it doesn't negate our own experiences by any means, it definitely helps you feel less alone and makes it feel more like a humanizing experience. Like, I'm not perfect. And, you know, I'm depressed sometimes, and sometimes people go through depression for long bits of time, and that doesn't make them less than or weak. It just means that you're human.
100%. What's on our next episode, Sam? What are we doing?
So we're going to be talking more about Maura Murray, but we're going to be going a little bit more into the dynamics and suspicions, I think, and different characters will be coming into play about who was seen as suspects and why, as well as we're going to talk about like what's really feasible, like what we think really could have happened, and not just what we think, more factually what happened and why were they suspects, and
or who her close circle, like, yeah, to like exactly. The people what did they say? In her life, like what was going on before she headed out to the place where she ended up eventually going missing and disappearing.
Like the backstory.
The backstory.
More at UMass. UMass. A little bit more about UMass, I think.
Yep. The time in nursing. So, yeah. So that, and hopefully we'll have Amy with us next time. You're going to hear from Amy. She's pretty well versed in this case, too. And again, I just want to thank you guys for listening. Send us an email. Let us know what you want to hear about. And then we're going to start on our next episode. We're going to have our little nurses station corner moments. And we're going to also do some case in the news updates or some hot cases in the news. So we're just going to do quick segments about different cases that are interesting and stuff that maybe is happening, like a trial is going to be starting soon. So we will start those segments on our next episode, and we'll have Amy with us too. So we'll introduce her. Is there anything you're watching or reading right now, Sam?
I am watching Hell's Kitchen right now.
Me too!
Season 18, I think.
Okay, definitely. I'm all caught up, so I'm watching the newest season.
Obsessed lately. Really trying to up my chef's kiss game, you know? Really.
HelloFresh, not a sponsor.
True.
We're both
not a sponsor yet. Not a sponsor yet.
Come on, HelloFresh.
Let me just say, big fan.
Big fan. We both
big fan.
We both use the vegan, HelloFresh.
Vegan, vegetarian meals, come on, unmatched.
All of them,
salmon. Absolutely delightful. If you'd like to sponsor us, HelloFresh, I would not say no.
Yeah, you know, we're asking for anything right now. Come on.
But I'm just saying.
So we're watching those Hell's
discounts.
Kitchen.
And just so you know, if you're a frontline worker, you get a discount on HelloFresh as well.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, or a veteran. Saying. Veteran, military.
We'll drop our HelloFresh codes, don't you worry.
But not a sponsor yet. Maybe someday.
Got your kittens, don't worry.
Oh, okay. Talk about Hell's Kitchen. Can I ask you how much you love Gordon Ramsay, dad?
When
he becomes Dad Gordon Ramsay.
Yes, Dad Gordon Ramsay, 100%. It's just like the switch flips, and it's like, oh my goodness.
Like goosebumps, like I love this man. Like, he's just dad.
Literally. It just, he's ready for any scenario. I'm like, see the way he yells at these people in the kitchen. He goes
calling someone a donut to, like, just being like, just.
You absolute fucking donut.
Get the fuck out. Fuck off.
You know what? Get out of my kitchen and fuck off.
You.
I've had it.
Out.
You're done.
But then, like, you know, he'll come back and he'll build you up. And
yeah, it's all the psychology.
Dad and, oh, it's that show is just perfect.
Great. Ugh.
So I'm watching The Challenge, MTV Challenge, which that's a show that goes way back. It used to be Real World. I'm kind of aging myself. But me and Jim, that's kind of our go-to. Whenever The Challenge is on every week, like, that's our show. And also Hell's Kitchen. So MTV Challenge just started a new season. And then I'm not reading it right now. I have read it. But obviously, going with our episode, please, please, please check out James Renner's book, True Crime Addict. And with that, thank you guys for tuning in to Messy Motives and the Macabre. Am I saying it right? Did I say it right?
You did. Macabre. Corn of the cob. Macabre. Me and Macabre.
I don't know how I said macabre. Macabre. Macabre.
Macabre.
I just thought that the way it was spelled, it was supposed to be said like French accent, macabre. Like fancy.
I'm pretty sure it's macabre.
It's just macabre.
Like macabre. Me and Macabre.
Like a cob on the corn? Corn yeah. Macabre.
Cob on the corn. I love that. I'm going to say it like that now.
We had to have the macabre because you guys may hate this, but we don't care. It's our show.
We love alliteration.
It's our show. But we're going to be talking some spooky shit, you know? Mm-hmm. I think my thing, because, we didn't really explain, but we'll probably explain this in the intro. I can cut all this out. But we're going to be taking turns picking cases. So Maura Murray, that is my, we call it white whale case. It's like the first case that got me into podcasting, true crime. I mean, I've always loved true crime, unsolved mysteries, all that stuff. But Maura Murray, that case just really captured me. And I think everybody has their case that
it's like your true crime, that. Cherry. It's like the one crime, that really just got you, like, that like stuck with you. And you're like, I can't let it go. Like,
exactly.
I can't let it go.
And it's like that for a lot of people that stumble onto the Maura Murray case. They get lost in it. Some people I know, you know, JonBenet Ramsey's their white whale case. Mm-hmm. All kinds of cases out there. We're going to take turns picking cases. There's three of us, so whoever's case it is going to be kind of in charge of telling the story, walking everybody through, and then the other of us, it's kind of commentary, ask questions. And then when it goes all the way around, the last case, it's going to be a case that we choose to do all together, I think. We'll see how it goes. But me personally, I think I'm going to be alternating between a true crime case and then a spooky case.
I like that.
But the next case, I'm not going to give it away. It has a little bit of both. It's paranormal and it's a murder investigation. And I think the two are very tied together. So, I mean, talking about something like Dudley Town, Roanoke, it's paranormal, but it's also very much a true crime story.
This is true. This is true.
Thank you guys so much. Have a good evening. Guys. We'll see you next week back in the basement.
Bye.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing. Testing. What?
Probably don't have any listeners if we ever will. If you are listening to us, we really appreciate it. You probably already turned us off.
No.
Who knows what would happen if one of us went missing.
And so, like, if you're like, hey, I know I wasn't supposed to be doing this, and this looks bad, but it wasn't me. I was supposed to meet up with her that night, but it wasn't me.
Right.
It's just going to look sus. It's just going to look mad sus.
But through the woods in a snowy woods at night where she's never been. I mean, she's been through there, but she doesn't know those woods.
Right. Then we got who else with Scott Peterson trying to get a freaking new trial.
Is he really?
Yeah. There's a lot of people that think he's innocent. Scott.
I heard that there were some jackasses out there.
I have something to tell you guys.
Guilty.
Right?
Guilty.
100% guilty.
Shocking.
Come on. And he even, not only is he guilty of killing his wife and putting her in a boat.
Yep.
And unborn child.
Yep.
He let the poor family dog out wander around the neighborhood everywhere.
Insult to injury. Oh, so, he's so gross.
To set up his story, because the story he gave is that Lacey was walking the dog.
Right.
So this motherfucker put the dog on a leash and just let it go.
Yep.
Could have got hit by a car. Mm-hmm. Could have got strangled because the leash is attached to its neck.
Yep.
So obviously he's a piece of shit human because he's murdered people. But when you bring a dog into it.
Absolutely. Draw the line there.
And you put the dog's life at risk. That's it.
We're coming for you, Scott.
You're done.